Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and wow, do we have a treasure to share with you today. Today, we are bringing you an interview that we just conducted just minutes before recording this with film director Werner Herzog and his collaborator, the volcanologist Clive Oppenheimer. And this was so powerful.
That's right. They have a new documentary, Fireball, Visitors from Darker Worlds, and it debuts November 13th, 2020, only on Apple TV+. It's an Apple original film.
You know, in the past few days, I've just been mainlining Herzog documentaries, all three actually involving Clive Oppenheimer. So the first one was his, I think it was 2007 film, Encounters at the End of the World, that's all about people in Antarctica and how they ended up there, what they're doing there. And one of them is this volcano researcher named Clive Oppenheimer, who's studying Mount Erebus. And this started a partnership between Werner Herzog and Clive Oppenheimer. So they've worked together on a couple of films since then. One was a fantastic documentary about volcanoes called Into the Inferno. And now this new one called Fireball, which is all about space impacts and meteorites.
That's right. Yeah, this one is directed by Herzog and Oppenheimer, and it's written and narrated by Herzog. These are both tremendous documentaries. I feel like they're very much the sort of documentaries that Stuff to Blow Your Mind listeners would enjoy, because they are obsessed with not only science, but human culture and where the two meet, how our understanding or interpretations of cosmic or geologic events impact the formation and the continuation of culture.
I feel like we shouldn't delay any longer. Should we go right to the interview?
Let's do it. Let's jump right in. Werner Herzog and Clive Oppenheimer, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
We both watched this documentary along with your previous collaboration, Into the Inferno, and we love them both. Both fabulous explorations of science and culture. Where did the idea for Fireball come from, and when did you film it?
Well, it came from Clive, but he has to explain.
Yeah, so about a year after the release of Into the Inferno, I had been working through one or two concepts for another film, but it was actually by chance on a trip to South Korea. I visited the Korean Polar Research Institute, And they gave me a tour of the facility, and I saw their meteorite collection. They go every year down to Antarctica and hunt for meteorites. They've got 1,000 already, but they're hoping they'll find something new. And it was while speaking with the meteorite expert there and just looking at these wonderful stones that have fallen from space, that it just seemed that this was another very obvious, ostensibly a geoscience topic, but one that immediately touches on human culture, on our origins of life, human origins, thinking about the massive impact 65 million years ago that reset the biological clock on Earth. 3/4 of species went to the wall. It speaks to our destiny. And there was something also about the scientific veneration of these stones. Each was in a cubicle, like a microwave oven with a window, but in a nitrogen atmosphere to preserve them. And they were all in a...
Must have been the feeling like in a Catholic church, the relics of saints. Behind glass and preserved somehow and untouchable.
That's right. You know, there were real veneration, and it was an echo for me of the veneration of one of the holiest relics of Islam, the Black Stone, which is also thought probably to be meteoritic. So that really inspired me, and back home I put together some ideas of how these themes might fit together, and I gave Werner a call. That was the start of it. Production, we were filming last year. We started filming in 1st of August, I think, last year, and through to Christmas Eve. We were editing. We finished editing in January, so we were very, very fortunate to do the real work that involved a lot of travel before all the lockdowns were in place. And so the post-production was done in Europe and LA, but you know, this was possible despite the lockdowns.
It's funny that you mentioned the idea of comparing the meteorites in their cases to the saints and the relics, because of course the nitrogen that they keep them in there, it's basically to make them incorruptible, right?
Yeah,
that's right. And you know, particularly the meteorites, the so-called carbonaceous meteorites, carbonaceous chondrites that have an extraordinary complement of organic molecules, things like ribose, a sugar, amino acids, the building blocks of life. These are completely abiotic. And yet, I mean, to me, this, you know, even as a geoscientist, I hadn't really taken on board just the complexity and abundance of organic molecules in certain meteorites. And so I find it very credible, the idea that these have delivered the building blocks, the ingredients of life, not only in our solar system but elsewhere, and you know, maybe all it takes is for one of them to find the right environment with the right kind of temperatures or heating and cooling cycles, wetting and drying cycles, in order to start to build very simple living organisms.
One of my favorite scenes in the movie is actually when you're sniffing one of these meteorites. And so I was wondering what that smells like. I'd actually read in other places that some meteorites smell like cruciferous vegetables, like rotting cabbage or like Brussels sprouts. I think in the film you might have compared it to mothballs. Is that right?
Yeah, mothballs. It had a very pungent smell. I mean, you remember that these are molecules that are 4.5 billion years old. And this was something, again, I had no idea of, you know, that you could sniff a meteorite and get such a strong smell off it. Contents of a vacuum cleaner bag is another way of maybe capturing what it's like. It's quite hard to describe, but unmistakable that there is an odor to these stones. And they've even used dogs sometimes to help find them, because they can sniff them out.
Clive, it's funny because I really wanted to take a sniff of it as well, but I restrained myself because I had the feeling I would breathe on it and there would be vapor. on it, or maybe my nose would be dripping on it. And what a catastrophe that would mean to wipe out the scent of 4,500 million years back in time. So I didn't do it. I have to rely on you to report what it was.
It would have been an interesting scientific paper and a fairly humiliating retraction later when they realized that it was the snot that had dribbled out of your nostrils.
Well, that reminds me of one of my favorite details leading up to that scene. Werner, I thought it was interesting how when you're going into the lab where some of these meteorites are stored under these tight containment procedures to keep them safe from contamination and degradation, there's a moment where you focus on the sticky mat that everyone has to walk through to go into the room. And that seemed like a detail that was very characteristic of your eye for documentaries to me. You noticing these interesting peripheral or process details that often wouldn't become the subject matter of another documentary. Why do you think you notice things like that so often?
Well, you would never see it on in a film by National Geographic or PBS or HBO. You don't see that. And I loved it. And not only that it was sticky and this crazy, I think, greenish color when you rip it off, the kind of ripping sound it makes. And I loved the sound, and I had repeated it a few times because I wanted to have the sound recorded very well. So those are things, of course, that point out you are entering a very specific, a very special sphere. There's something special. You do not walk in with your shoes that you wore out in the street. They have to be cleansed. And you enter with a certain preparation. The camera enters prepared. And the audience enters prepared. So you always have to anticipate an audience behind you. And of course, it means you're never going to be boring. You never will be didactic. There has to be human. It has to be awesome. And of course, there's a separate second story within the audience that you have to prepare. The curiosity of the audience, the engagement of the audience. And those are the moments where you really capture them, where you really walk with them into this connection.
That sort of leads into the next thing I wanted to ask, which is I was wondering about when you're looking at something awe-inspiring, say you're standing in a colossal impact crater or you're looking at the exposed magma in the caldera of a volcano, how do you think your experience is colored by the fact that you are there to document it, whether that's for science, Clive, or for film, Werner, as opposed to just being there and witnessing it with no real documentary mission?
Well, for me, there is no distinction. I do my job and I enjoy the moment. And I somehow, of course, in some cases, there's some danger when you are getting too close to a crater, an active crater that is spitting out particles in magma and slabs large as a truck. And they come down, so you better watch out what you are doing. So, but it's where life and filmmaking has no distinction.
I think for me, I do sense some distinction. I mean, particularly in my scientific work on volcanoes, and I think it's actually true as well of the filmmaking. When you're making a film, or when I'm trying to measure the gas coming out of a volcano, you have to think about an awful lot of things all at the same time. You have to be flexible. If you're trying to make gas measurements on a volcano, you need to worry all the time, which way is the wind blowing? What's the volcano doing? Is it safe to be here? Why isn't the equipment working? And, you know, in some ways, this is so absorbing that actually, you're not having a transcendental moment about where you are. And it's maybe when everything is working just great, and the data is being collected and you can just set aside and then stop and think, well, my goodness, look where I am. I'm on the side of an active volcano crater in Antarctica, and it's minus 40 degrees Celsius. And then you're really aware of where you are and what it feels like to be there.
And Clive, there's also a certain, for me, as filmmaking, you become more fearless because you're doing your job. And that has cost, for example, war correspondents during the Vietnam War, the amount of casualties and fatalities you had among the war photographers was staggeringly high, because they step into the crossfire and they take photos of one side and photos of the other side firing at each other, and they are right in the middle of it. And then they perish. And a camera gives you this kind of quasi feeling of invulnerability. And having Clive around, for example, in Indonesia, where we were filming a volcano that had come back to life, Clive insisted we have to turn the car around so that we can flee. And you can't turn the car around on a ditch, country ditch road or so, which is not much wider than the car. So we had to go 1 mile further down and turn it around and then come back. And Clive made sure the car has to face an exit. And all of a sudden, we are seeing something and the camera films it in an eruption. And Clive says to us, stop the camera, load it now, and we flee. And we actually fled. And 7 days later, I think 11 peasants who were doing farm work exactly at that same spot perished in a similar eruption.
Now this is interesting. In thinking about not only the craft of creating the documentary, but the experience of creating the documentary, I was curious. Obviously you're going into it with certain ideas in mind, and then there's the shoot itself, and then I imagine some reflection afterwards. What is the experience as just a curious individual like of going on this journey? Do you find yourself coming out at the other end with like a different idea or a different consideration of, say, near Earth objects or meteorites?
No, we are always ready for surprises. And Clive is wonderful in doing conversations, spontaneous conversations. Of course, he's extremely well prepared. When we filmed with the lay brother in the Vatican, a Jesuit, Clive had read the doctoral dissertation of that man, which was written in 1979. And he quotes from this. So who, for heaven's sake, is prepared like him? That's one side. But the conversation can go anywhere. And of course, all of a sudden he asks him if green men would come out from a spacecraft, would you baptize them? And the Jesuit said yes, but only if they asked for it. So the conversation has to go its own course. And But you do not walk away having done that film and you're a changed man. You see, that's a postulate of the silly Hollywood screenplays. A person by page 30 has to know his task, and by page 60, he or she has to undergo the crisis, and by the end of the film, he or she has to exit the film as a changed person. Not so for us. We are. I always quote the Bavarian proverbial saying, we are we, and we spell us. And by the way, I would never allow Clive to have a piece of paper in his hand. I said, we are not journalists. We do not have a catalogue of questions. Let the thing roll and let's tumble through it.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astepro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astepro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astepro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astepro. Go to AstaproAllergy.com for a discount so you can get Astepro and go today. AsteproAllergy.com. Astepro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. Just $25 a month, every month. Taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
So there's a moment in Fireball I wanted to talk about where Clive, where you are looking at micrometeorites under an extremely powerful microscope under magnification, and you notice that the surfaces of the dust grains that come down from space look in some ways like the surfaces of moons or rocky planets. And this is something I've read about in the geological world as well as in the biological sciences, geometrical patterns and textures that can be found repeating at vastly different levels of resolution. Do you have thoughts about this, Clive? Like, why does the microscopic so often mirror the astronomical?
It's a good question. I hadn't thought of that, but these are cosmic dust micrometeorites that were found by one of Norway's most famous jazz musicians, a wonderful guitarist, Jon Larsen, and he spent the last 10 years up on the roofs of sports arenas and in car parks, trawling, collecting all the sludge of the urban, but finding in it, and he's found several thousand meteoritic grains now. And these under high magnification, they look absolutely wonderful. And you know, you would love to have one at a large size sitting in your living room. They're so beautiful to behold. But to answer your question, I mean, I wonder if one of the reasons why it struck me that this one of these particular grains, it seemed to have fractures in it that looked like almost like icebergs. That had very kind of polygonal cracks and fissures between them, and then there was something that looked like it could be a coastline that they'd broken off from. And it may be that some of the processes are the same, just at very different scales. And I'm thinking of things like fluid dynamics. There are guiding principles, the force of gravity, the fluidity of something, how viscous, how sticky it is when it's trying to flow. And these processes operate at vastly different spatial scales. And so maybe that's why there is some inherent similarity that we sometimes see.
Jive, I think you have it in the very abstract as well. And it's a very deep question about the nature of the universe. You have it in mathematics. In fractals and things where all of a sudden certain patterns reappear on a very large scale, and the more minuscule you get, they keep repeating itself. So there seems to be something inherent in nature that we do not understand fully yet. And it's a very beautiful thought to pursue this kind of pattern that manifests itself all of a sudden. And why is it that on a very large scale you have patterns that you find in a microscopic scale in almost same optical impression you have?
And then we have the exception, the pattern that never repeats itself, the quasi-crystal with the forbidden fivefold symmetry, and yet which can be, you know, was discovered by artisans in Iran, tiling the shrine
half a millennium ago.
Yes, yes.
Not mathematicians like Penrose, who describes it mathematically. That has been one of the most fascinating elements in the film for me at all, because I did not know about quasi-crystals at all. And I have to point out, the earliest supporter of the film was the Simons Foundation, where they have a sandbox film department which supports films that have scientific background. And they are on a new trajectory now to attract new audiences to non-didactic sort of cinema about science. And the man who runs this, Greg Bosted, who is a scientist himself, he sent me a book written by Paul Steinhardt, a cosmologist who actually was in search of quasi-crystals for more than 30 years. And he's in the film, and he's a wonderful character, shy and never been out in wild nature. I say in my commentary, the deepest contact with the wild nature was the lawns at Princeton University, and all of a sudden he goes on an expedition into easternmost Siberia, close to the Bering Strait, into the underbrush and wild bears around and clouds of mosquitoes. And he finds remnants of small fragments of a meteorite that carried quasi-crystals. And it was proven, yes, they exist in nature, out there in the universe. And it had been proven. And it's a wonderful, wonderful story. And for me, totally fascinating, because I'm fascinated by mathematical things like that. How is it possible that a structure in crystals that is unthinkable should be even forbidden, and it was forbidden almost to think about it, can be proven after understanding a certain pattern? just wonderful, these kind of manifestations. And I would be, if I didn't make films, I would like to go into mathematics, but you have to start as a child to be really into it. Because I would like to be on the forefront of finding out about Riemann's theory, Riemann's hypothesis about prime numbers, distribution of prime numbers. Those things really, really fascinate me.
Well, I had wondered if maybe I was reading Faces in Clouds when I saw this connection in your work, but I was thinking even in the earlier movie in Into the Inferno, I thought I saw, Werner, in your eye for the film, this idea of repeating patterns, because I noticed there's the scene where you're searching for shattered fragments of ancient human bone in the East African Rift in Ethiopia, and then immediately you cut to the exposed magma surface in the caldera of the nearby volcano, and the cooling surface has cracks in it that look almost exactly like the edges of the bone fragments that that Clive, you were just picking out with I believe it was Tim White of Berkeley, the paleoanthropologist. Was that on purpose, or no, am I just making crazy connections there?
No, I've never been aware of that. You are the first one who points it out. To look at it again, of course, it was not fast. It was not on purpose to make this connection. But you have the privilege as an audience to make these connections that did not occur to me. And nor did, I think, occur to Clive.
No, but it's a wonderful resonance. And I can still watch Into the Inferno, which I have seen a good few times now. And I will make a connection. I will see a motif reappearing somewhere that I hadn't spotted before. And I think that's, for me, the joy of making these kinds of films. For me, they're more like a piece of music that you love and would listen to again and again. I feel with these films and with Werner's films that I could watch Aguirre many, many times and never be bored of it. So that's part of the joy of this kind of cinema. I would say accidental things coming good. One of my favorite bits of film in Fireball is when we're up on the polar plateau and filming the meteorite search with the Koreans. And the camera was on for about half an hour without us realizing it. So it's just being carried around and it's pointing all over the place. But we looked at this footage and there was just one, 10, 5, 8 seconds worth of just, it was just beautiful. The shadows of our team cast on the blue ice, and because there were shadows, it gave a depth into the ice, into this extraordinary glacial ice. Just beautiful and completely accidental.
So, Werner, you've emphasized the ways that high-energy natural phenomena like volcanic eruptions and impacts from space can reveal us to be very tiny and insignificant and powerless, but in this documentary and in Into the Inferno, you show a lot of the ways that people are drawn to exactly the sites of these phenomena when they're trying to build a mythology that gives their life meaning. Is there a counterintuitive logic at work here? Does evidence of our insignificance and helplessness somehow kind of give courage to the part of us that finds a way to view our lives as part of a sacred story or having a point?
Well, that's a very profound question, and I have never thought about it for a long time. But of course, just looking at the universe, when you look at the stars, when you're outside of a city where you really see the universe, and it, of course, gives you an understanding of size. And when you're in Antarctica, you get an understanding of you can walk straight for the next 5,000 kilometers, like walking across the entire continental United States, and you will not find a human soul. And at the same time, the fact that the day will last for 5 months until the sun settles, because it's circling in Antarctica during the Austral summer. So it gives a scale of size and importance. And of course, vis-a-vis the universe, which is monumentally indifferent to us. We have to understand the size, and yet at such moments we can also understand that the here and now and what we are has a certain importance, and we do the best out of the moment. We create our own consciousness to some degree, and we are responsible for what we are doing, and we are big in what we are doing here. So it's a strange balance, and it sounds like a contradiction, but it is not.
I would add, I believe, you know, that we are very much disconnected now. I mean, more than half of us live in cities, in urban environments, and artificial light has colonized our night. And you know, how many of us can remember the last time we saw the Milky Way? And I think that does disconnect us from that sense of awe of the natural world, of the
course. So if you heard some story about the earthquake in the valley.
Yes, the 1994, the Northridge earthquake in LA. This struck in February, I think, in the middle of the night. And so people ran outside their homes, and pretty soon a number are calling the emergency services because...
Yeah, 911 calls.
They could see a strange silvery cloud in the sky, and they thought maybe this was some noxious fumes given off from the San Andreas Fault. But what had happened, the earthquake had knocked out the power grid. And so for the first time, they were seeing the Milky Way, which, you know, they had no idea what it was. It's
people called 911
emergency. You can completely understand it. I live in a village outside Cambridge in England, but there's way too much light pollution here to see more than a dozen stars at night. And I think that's meaningful, actually. It has an impact on human society. That we no longer have that sense of wonder of the infinite and of the nocturnal, because we've lost it for so many of us.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Every now and then you hear of various actors being described as a force of nature, or their performance being a force of nature that must be crafted or honed by a director. Werner, what do you make of such comparisons, especially having worked with actual volcanoes and alongside other legitimate forces of nature in your films?
You're not thinking about Klaus Kinski, are you?
Well, certainly he's an actor that comes to mind. You hear occasionally such performers compared to a force of nature.
Yeah, but you hear that in cheap Hollywood affirmative reviews. It's riveting and whatever. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean.
Yes.
So you should be careful in using this kind of lingo that you hear in advertisements for mainstream Hollywood movies being praised by paid off mainstream reviewers. So anyway, but if you mean somebody like Nicolas Cage in Bad Lieutenant, or Klaus Kinski in Wojciech, sure, yes, there is something extraordinary about performances and intensity and the presence on screen, which is completely unique and remarkable. And you do not find it very often, but you do find it. And you do find it like Timothy Treadwell, Grizzly Man. And in a way, Clive has a presence on camera which is unique for a film like that. We only have David Attenborough, but it's prepared texts, well-written texts, but he puts a kind of excitement into it, and he deserves being so famous and being so loved by audiences. A wonderful character. But Clive has something which I really like as a strong presence on screen: the sense of awe, the sense of respect, the sense of discovery. And if we have a person like him in a film, and we have not, we don't pursue this kind of lifeless scientific documentaries, and we find a man like him in front of a camera, wonderful. So I've been very lucky that I ran into Clive on top of an active volcano in Antarctica at 12,500 feet altitude, 30 degrees below zero or something. And he wore a tweed jacket or something. He denies it was a tweed jacket.
It wasn't a tweed jacket. The Harris Tweed clan will be tracking you down. But it, I mean,
what was it? But it looked like a tweed jacket, or like the early Himalaya climbers, some early Mount Everest climbers would tackle the mountain in tweed jackets.
Well, this was a Himalayan jacket. It was from Kulu Manali in India. So I've never been a huge fan for synthetic fibers. I like to wear wool and cotton and all sorts of things you're not supposed to wear anymore in Antarctica. I don't use Finisco and the real old timers did. But I guess my tweed jacket is pretty close to what Mallory wore.
Yeah, we use it as a metaphor now, but your appearance was striking and the way you talked and what you had to say was just wonderful. So that's where we started to notice each other. And Clive actually, I think on the same or on the following day, said, I have a camera myself. Can I speak to you? But I would like to record it on my camera. So Clive was into filmmaking already.
It was really the first filmmaking I'd done. I was collaborating with an Italian photographer and artist on a video installation.
For the Biennale in Venice. Was it correct?
That's an interesting point. So when we were putting this thing together, so Armin Linke is the name of the artist, and he thought we might have a showing at the Biennale. Well, you can imagine coming out of the Ivory Tower in Cambridge how excited I was at that prospect. It didn't go to Venice. It went to the Festivale Internazionale per Redobagno in Bologna, which I'm sure you know is the big global event in toilet furnishings. If you're into toilet furnishings, you're in Bologna for the Cersei convention. The installation had been commissioned by a very large ceramics company. They'd made a new product called Volcanic Stone. And so, this is why I had a character point, Werner. But that mission to Antarctica, it was, I'd say, very much a turning point for me because I had this camera and I was feeling creative to be behind the camera and not only thinking about measuring volcanic gases, but of course it was also my encounter with Werner. And I'd been interested in the idea of making a volcano documentary. For a number of years. And my motivation for that was distaste for most volcano documentaries. I mean, coming from knowing something about the topic, I knew watching a lot of these documentaries, they were all identical. They all had the line of it's not a matter of if she blows, it's when, and then cut into the commercial break. So I already had a longing to do more than that because so much of the documentary, there are some good ones, but most, they go for the low-hanging fruit. It's doom and gloom, and it's not the interesting stories. It's not the nuance. It's not the entanglements of nature and culture. So I thank my lucky stars that I ran into Werner up on this 12,500-foot high volcano in Antarctica.
In both the Fireball and Into the Inferno, you speak with people about their beliefs and their traditions and the things that have impacted those cultures and traditions to sort of steer the direction of their worldviews. And in Inferno, you speak with individuals whose faith is sometimes classified as a cargo cult, a belief system born out of contact between Melanesian cultures and the Western military machine of the Second World War. What was that experience like to actually be there and speak with them and see them in person?
Well, I'd say, I mean, there were a couple of elders that we spoke with in Vanuatu for Into the Inferno. One, as you say, was the cargo cult, the John Frum cult. And this was very interesting conversation. In that particular case, I think this cargo cult actually, if you look at its roots, it starts very much as a protest against the colonial authorities. And this is sort of back in the, I guess it's starting around the time of the Second World War. And people on the island of Tanna, they'd been in mission schools. They were just taught what the British wanted them to know. And they said, well, you know, we want to go back to our traditions. We want to drink again. We want to have our ceremonies. And so one of the first things they did was to stop buying goods from the English shops. And that really upset the colonial authorities. So they threw these guys in prison, you know, for 15 years. And so that's sort of what the cargo cult's born from. The other chap we spoke with, for me, you know, one of the most compelling conversations we've ever had on camera was with the chief of Endu village on Ambrim Island in the north of the Vanuatu archipelago. And he lives just a few miles from a very active volcano. At night, he'll see the glow from the crater. And so it's literally a looming presence and ever present on the landscape. And every now and then, ash will fall out across their plots of land. And he described his feelings on one visit he made to the crater, and he said, I looked in and I saw this stuff moving like the sea, you know, so I thought it was water, but it was red, so it can't be water. What is it? And the way he describes this makes complete sense. Okay, I've trained in the geoscience, so I have a different perspective on it, but I find it very, very compelling how people formulate cosmologies when they're faced by these awesome phenomena. And I mean that in the sense of inspiring reverential fear as well as inspiring awe of just the wonder of seeing magma at night.
Clive, I would like to add two things, because for me it sounds too theoretical when you explain the colonial origins of cargo cults. Yes, sure, we can track it back to that, but still it remains very compelling and mysterious that we speak with people, or you speak with people, who believe that an American GI, John Frum, lives in Volcano, and he... The man with whom you speak has spent the whole night inside of the cauldron of the volcano. What were you talking about? So the presence and deification, the creation of a god out of a GI, an average GI, John Frum, is fantastic for me, and it had to be in the film. The second, which I remember was very important, we discussed how do you talk to them, the attitude, and you said, I know how to do it and I trust it, because it shouldn't be condescending, it shouldn't be patronizing, it shouldn't be funny, it shouldn't be, you see, and your quiet curiosity and respect is something which makes the scene unforgettable. So you have to have, when you do something like this, you have to have somebody of your caliber to do it right. And this was on our mind throughout all the conversations we had. And it was on our mind when we did conversations with, let's say, a female artist in Western Australia, an Aboriginal woman. And the way you talk to her and the way you are interested to understand her painting and how she explains it has a wonderful tone to it. And you do not see that in movies. You don't see it. But we were able to create it, and there's a lot of thinking behind it, and a lot of natural decency that's in you is behind it.
Werner, I would say in a lot of your movies, it seems one thing you enjoy capturing is a palpable sense of unpredictability about what's on camera. And that comes through even in the conversations. I would say a lot of the conversations that you capture in these films feel less scripted and less predictable and less worked out in advance than most conversations in documentaries do.
Yes, of course, because we trust in our ability to follow the moment, and we trust in our ability to go to the essence very quickly. So you see, we do not shoot endless hours and hours and hours. We go to Castel Gandolfo and we speak to the Jesuit lay brother. Neither Clive has met him in person, only on the phone, nor have I ever met him. We go in and in an hour flat or so, we are done filming. And it's wonderful. And we know we captured the essence of what we wanted to do. So we bring skills. We bring certain skills to the set that come to fruition in a very condensed way. And thanks God we have these capabilities, because otherwise we would have made a boring didactic film.
And we must acknowledge too that we're part of a team with you know, wonderful cinematographer Peter Zeitlinger, who was DOP for both of these films, and a sound engineer, recordist, Paul Paragon, both extraordinary professionals. The way Peter works with the camera it's very he's extraordinary. I mean, again, as Werner says, we turn up, we meet people for the first time, we've maybe had a few conversations on the phone, and we have a very clear sense of purpose of what we're after and what themes we want to dig into. But then the way Peter works with the camera is a marvel to behold. Paul, our sound recordist, you know, he'll be up at 5 o'clock in the morning before the birds are up to record a wonderful ambience that might then be woven into our soundtrack. So it's a collective effort with all of us knowing what we're doing. And how this is going to work out and fit together.
I would say one of my favorite examples in your recent films that I've heard of that sound gathering is in Encounters at the End of the World. You have a wonderful selection of sort of the commerce of the ice, all the inhuman sounds of the chucking made by the seals and the cracking of the ice behind you. It does give you a sense that there is a world taking place there that's utterly inhuman and yet is very active.
Yeah, I think this dates back to my very, very first films. We were a group of young people and we, teenagers, actually 18, 19 years old, and we all helped each other, 8 of us or 9 of us. Only 2 finished their films. One was a friend of mine, and the other one was me. And the others failed because of sound problems. And it gave me, and all of a sudden I became alert how important sound was. And it was of essence, and it can make a film fail. And out of 9 films, 7 failed because of sound problems. But it was young filmmakers, 18, 19, 20 years old, without any formal training. All of us didn't go to film school.
Now, you've both mentioned already what other documentaries do differently or have gotten wrong, perhaps. Can you both think to examples of documentaries you were exposed to early on that inspired you, that where you watched them and said, this is what I want to do. This is the sort of documentary I could see myself making.
Your question fundamentally aims beyond me, doesn't hit me. I always had the feeling I am the inventor of cinema. And I see documentaries where everything is done wrong, didactic, stupid, sensationalistic, understanding documentaries as part of journalism. And I said, get away from that. I only have negative definitions. Only the sins I can name, not the virtues.
So in viewing these documentaries, I couldn't help but think of The Divine Comedy. You know, we began, obviously, in The Inferno, and then Fireball is in some ways about a bridge between earth and sky, you know, the Mount of Purgatory. That just leads me to the obvious question. Like, what's next? If you were to do another documentary project together, what do you think you might consider?
I think Clive will come up with something fiendish.
Back to hell.
Yeah, I will. We have at least a trilogy in us. I feel that, and I've always got a few ideas that are half baked, and when I get time, I'll sit down and really have a think. Ultimately, I would like to move beyond scientific topics in my filmmaking. I'm very interested in other aspects of human culture. But I think for me, it's always about the complexities. And I think what one of the things, of course, that I've learned so much about through working with Werner is storytelling, is narrative. And I find it's even informing now my scientific writing, oddly enough. I think more in terms of how do I tell this story of this finding that I've got to, from some of my own research.
But whatever it is, you shall not be speeding toward the Empyrean at incalculable speed.
I think you're right to, you know, recognize these resonances between Fireball and Into the Inferno. I mean, these are geophysical, geological, celestial phenomena, volcanoes, asteroid collisions, meteorites, but they have so much more significance for humans in terms of what we think of our origins, what we think of the afterlife, our ideas of heaven, of the netherworld, of the underworld. These are very intimately bound with these terrestrial, earthly, subterranean, and celestial Empyrean phenomena.
All right. Well, there you have it. We hope you enjoyed this chat. We certainly enjoyed this particular interview. I felt like it was unlike any interview we've done before.
Yeah, it was like having an audience with a couple of wise and stern kings of the cosmos.
Yes. So, yeah, hopefully we didn't come off too starstruck in this one. Once again, if you want to check out the film, it is Fireball, Visitors from Darker Worlds, a film by Werner Herzog and Clive Oppenheimer. It is an Apple original film. It debuts November 13th, 2020, only on Apple TV+. In the meantime, if you would like to check out other episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, you can find us wherever you get your podcasts. And wherever that happens to be, we just ask that you rate, review, and subscribe. If you want to get to us rather quickly, you can always go to stufftoblowyourmind.com, and that will shoot you over to the iHeart page for our show. You can find all the episodes there as well. And there's also a button you can push for our store, and that'll take you to a place where you can buy some t-shirts, some stickers, etc., with our logo on them, or perhaps a monster or two.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross. Tiffany Cross. Join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. We gather a seasoned elder, myself as the middle generation, and a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations. Prepare to engage or hear perspectives that literally no one else has had. Listen to Across Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.